My name is Joshua Spodek. I'm an adjunct professor at NYU. I'm also a hustler, and also I'm an outlier.
Welcome to Outlier on Air with Ever Gonzalez, the show where we interview the founders, disruptors, and mavens of the world. Learn how grit, failure, and success are all a part of the entrepreneurial journey.
Hey everybody, welcome to Outlier on Air, the podcast where we interview founders, disruptors, and mavens. As always, I'm your host, Ever Gonzalez. On today's episode, we have Joshua Spodek. He is an adjunct professor at NYU. He's a hustler and an outlier. Joshua, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good to be here, Ever.
We're excited to have you here for many, many reasons. I personally enjoy your articles and the content that you're putting out. But above that, you are, I don't know how else to put this. You're a super human with everything that you've done. Let me just rattle off some of the things that that you've done and are currently doing. So you're an adjunct professor at NYU. You're a leadership coach. You offer workshops at Columbia Business School. You're a columnist at Inc. Magazine. Let's see here. You have 5 Ivy League degrees, including a PhD in astrophysics and an MBA. You've helped build an X-ray observational satellite for the European Space Agency and NASA. And you've also co-founded and led as CEO and COO several ventures. And you hold 6 different patents. A few other things. You've been to North Korea twice. You, as of right now, I'm assuming, I don't know if it's changed, 6 marathons. And you were an athlete with in nationals and worlds in ultimate frisbee. What is up with that? That's a lifetime. I mean, that's several lifetimes worth of stuff by itself. You're still a young guy, 44. Where do you find the time? Where do you find the passion? That's what I want to get into during our conversation for this episode. But before we do that, let's talk about where you're calling us from before we kind of dig in and get to the meat of your story.
Uh-huh. So I'm calling from New York City. I happen to be at Columbia University right now at the business school.
Very nice. How long have you been in New York? Born and raised there?
I was born in Philadelphia and I grew up there. And I went to Central High School, which is like it's like the magnet school there. And anyone who went there was like, oh, cool, Central. And I came to, you know, I was 10 years old. My dad took me for my birthday to New York City. It was my first time to New York City. And it was the same for my sisters when they turned 10 on their birthdays. And I, you know, now it's memories of memories of memories. But at the time, I was like, this is great. I love this here. And so when I graduated college, when I graduated high school, I came to Columbia undergrad. And I've basically been here ever since. I was back in Philadelphia to start grad school and was there for a year and a half then. I had a year in Paris, a year in Shanghai. But basically since then, I've been here. And to me, New York City feels like home like no other place.
Yeah, you've been a few different places, like we mentioned before. You've done a lot of things. You're still doing a lot of different things. Can you do what you do at that level anywhere else? I mean, would you be able to do this in L.A., San Francisco, Seattle, that kind of stuff? Or does the city kind of do something for you as far as the energy and the passion that surrounds the area?
There's a couple ways I would say that, I would answer that. Is that one is that if someone stuck me in some place and said, you can't leave this place, then I would find a way to be happy there. Mm-hmm. It would, you know, if I were stuck in, I don't know, pick a place. I don't know. If you stuck me in LA, I'd start surfing. If you stuck me in, I don't know, the middle of Asia, I'd start learning the language and start, you know, figuring stuff out there. And so it happens that New York seems to, how do I put it? It matches with me on a lot of things. It's like the mix of culture, the speed of the city, the size of the city, how much, you know, if you live here, you just have to wait and everyone, you know, will show up at some point. Mm-hmm. So it's very convenient for me. You know, a friend visited a little while ago. I went to the Museum of Modern Art for the first time in a while and that struck a chord and I really liked that. And that sort of thing, it's available all the time. I love running in Central Park. I love the culture. I love the food and things like that.
And one of the things that we'll talk about here in just a sec, you swam across the Hudson River as well. I mean, it almost sounds like it was just one of those things like, hey, how about we just swim across the Hudson? From what I can tell, there wasn't much planning and preparation behind it. You just, one of those things that, oh yeah, let's just go do this.
Yeah, there was, I mean, the original thing was I saw this movie called Motorcycle Diaries, which was a story about a guy who later became Che Guevara. Mm-hmm. And there's a scene in the movie where he swims across the Amazon River. And a little while later, I was looking across the Hudson and asking myself, like, I knew that that distance, if I were to run that distance, if there weren't a river there, I could easily run it. And I had no idea if I could swim that distance. And I joked around for a little while with people, like, could you swim across the Hudson? And it was kind of fun cocktail party humor about dead bodies floating up or PCBs from GE or something like that. And one friend of mine just said, let's do it. And this friend of mine is like, he's like a baller. We always have fun together. And when he said that, I realized that's why I was telling. So it wasn't for the jokes, because they got kind of boring after a little while. It was because I wanted someone to kick me in the butt. And like, so it was winter when he said that, and we weren't going to, that was not going to go in the winter, but eventually we got on a ferry from Manhattan to New Jersey, threw away our shoes and shirts. He had picked up a couple, he picked up a couple waterproof disposable cameras, and I put a $20 bill in my shorts pocket, and so we swam across. And
is that a mile across? How what's the distance?
Yeah, when I look at the map online, it looks like the total distance we went was about a mile. Mm-hmm. Now the current took us down a lot farther than I expected it would. So it's like about a kilometer across, and then with the extra distance that the water took us, it came out to about a mile.
You know, so on the surface, it doesn't seem that difficult, or at least the thought, right? Swimming across for about a mile. People do it all the time, swimming a mile. But how dangerous was it? Was it dangerous?
Well, I mean, it's tough to say because, I mean, two of us went and we both lived, so that says it wasn't that dangerous. Uh-huh. And I'd run marathons by this point, so I knew that I had the heart and lungs to get myself across. And when you run, if you're tired, you can just walk for a little bit and then you get some energy back and you run some more. And I figured I can tread water forever. So we got in the water and started swimming. And I'd swim for a bunch and then tread water a little, swim for a bunch and tread water for a little. But I didn't count on the current. Like, it was going faster than I thought. And when we finally got across, we were at 45th Street. We started somewhere in like the 60s.
Oh, nice.
And you can start seeing where Manhattan curves away from you. So I was getting a little worried about if I treaded water too long, I could miss the island. And I wouldn't say that I panicked, but I was definitely feeling like this is kind of like, I didn't want to put in a big effort to get to the end, because if I put in a big effort, tired myself out completely and missed the pier, then I might not have enough energy to, you know, actually finish the last bit. But my friend who didn't tell me this, he had a decent amount of open water swimming. I don't know why.
Oh, but look, nice.
He got in the water and the waves are bigger than in a swimming pool. They're smaller than the ocean, but, you know, we're swimming, not just playing in the water. And we're swimming for a little bit. And he says, you know, if you swim on a backstroke, it keeps your mouth out of the water. And I was like, oh, that's cool. So I started backstroking most of the way. That's the picture on my blog, is me backstroking. And it wasn't until after, like a week later, that I was like, how did he know about the backstroke? Like, that's not something you would just casually know. And looking back, I realized when he put his hands in the water, there was like no splashing. And I realized like he was better at swimming in the water in a river than I was. Luckily, because he would swim a bunch ahead and then wait up for me. And
nice.
Swim a bunch ahead up for me. Yeah, without him, it would have been much more difficult.
What was plan B? I mean, was there a plan B?
I left a note in my apartment. It was a note to my parents saying if I washed up somewhere that wasn't like I was unsatisfied or unhappy. I was just doing something to live my life.
Oh, shit. And yeah, this is not a suicide note. I'm just letting you know what happened. Nice.
Yeah, it was like leave everything to my nieces and nephews.
So I like the story for a couple of different reasons, right? I mean, it's who would ever think, hey, let's swim across the Hudson, right? Because I lived in New York for a couple of years, and I always thought that's filthy water, but I guess it's not as filthy as I thought it was. But this was, you know, 15, 20 years ago. But now who says I'm going to swim across and I'm just going to do it? Were you pushing yourself physically, or were you pushing yourself mentally at that point? I mean, what was the point of this whole thing?
It was a little of each.
Mm-hmm.
I think that one of the big things, okay, the research that we did consisted of looking on the web, finding nothing really there of whether it could be done, whether there's illegal or not, water quality, anything like that. We didn't find anything meaningful. The one thing we found was that there have been swims in the Hudson. They were up and down the river, not side to side. And the city, somehow it was endorsed by the city in some way. And that told me a city has deep pockets. How unhealthy could it be if they're going to pick up that kind of liability? It must not be that unhealthy.
Yeah.
I don't know if that logic is sound, but that was enough.
But it was something, yeah.
I'll tell you, on the New Jersey side, when we got in, there's these big boulders that we climbed over, and then we put our feet in the water, and the riverbed, there's only one way to describe it. Because it didn't feel like silt or pebbles. It felt like guacamole.
Oh,
and I was like, what is that?
Nice.
I mean, the water feels it. It was, you put your hand in like an inch, you can't see. Like the visibility was nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't, so we had to swim instead of walking at the beginning because we didn't want our feet in that. I don't know what it was.
I bet. You don't want to know what it was.
Yeah.
Nice. And so how long did it take you to cross?
You know, I didn't have a watch with me. I think it was about an hour. I mean, I met him at 8 a.m. We both live in the West Village. And, well, he's since moved, but at the time he lived in the West Village. And I walked over to his place, and his girlfriend walked him down, and we walked up to, I think 34th Street is where the ferry was. Then took the ferry across, swam back. Then this was another fun part, is that, so we got back on land at around 45th Street, and then from there we walked home barefoot with no shirts.
Mm-hmm.
Just nice. A pair of shorts and wet.
And in New York City, that probably wasn't a big deal.
Yeah, that actually wasn't that big of a deal. I mean, the bare feet was kind of, you just have to check where you're stepping. And anyway, I think it was 8 a.m. I think we got back at 1 p.m. So that whole thing was that long. And the time in the water was, I think, about an hour.
So
I got sunburned.
When you got out of the water in the Manhattan side, then what? I mean, you like you said, you just walked home?
Well, I mentioned I had $20 in my pocket, so uh-huh. We bought a couple of beers.
To celebrate, sure.
Yeah, and then there were all these people, like, they weren't coming after us, but there were people like, were you guys the ones in the water? And we figured there probably weren't that many people in the water, so it must have been us.
Have other people attempted it? I mean, there must have been other people. Do you know of any others that have done it?
Well, I do know that one time I was running down, I lived not too far from the Hudson, so I run along the Hudson for, you know, when I run. And there was a swim, I believe, that might have gone to Liberty Island. And people must have figured out the currents and stuff. And they must have, I think that there were like people in boats or buoys along the way to make sure the course was safe, because there were a lot of people doing it. And I saw people in wetsuits. So I know that there was that. And every now and then someone will contact me to ask me if, you know, they're thinking about doing it. No one has contacted me and said that they've done it.
Sure.
I have a feeling that before there were modern New York City, I'm sure people swam it all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, there wasn't the George Washington Bridge at one point. And I would guess people did it a lot, but I don't know.
Well, that's interesting. That's one of those things that, you know, you can be proud of and talk about at parties and things like that. But at the time, it must have been scary, awesome, exciting, you know, all those things wrapped into one. And so now looking back, we kind of talked about this. Looking back, though, what was the biggest lesson or the biggest thing you got out of it?
I'm glad you asked, because there's an adventure piece to it, and there's like a thrill. But the biggest thing is that, okay, a friend of mine, her boss was really into skydiving, and he kept trying to get her to go skydiving, and the only way she would go is if I had to go with her. So one time I went skydiving, and I won't lie, it was amazing. It was really a great experience. I'm glad I did it. But before I did it, I thought it's a very passive thing. And after doing it, I realized like the falling is really fun, because it's the longest I've ever not had something underneath me. And you're going really fast, and it's kind of peaceful, especially when the parachute goes out. But you get there, you sign a form, you do what you're told. It's like an amusement park ride. It's thrilling, but no freedom in it. There's nothing of your volition. And a marathon is something that's entirely of your volition. You know, you have to take every step, but it doesn't have that thrill. It doesn't have that risk. You can always stop if you get injured, no problem. And the thing is that you don't have to bungee jump. You don't have to skydive. You don't have to do all these crazy things to get an amazing life experience. Nature is out there. You can do these things. Kids climb trees, but somehow as adults, we lose that. And I don't think there's really that much of risk. I mean, it's possible something mm-hmm. could have happened, but it didn't. And so your Hudson River is out there. Maybe you don't want to swim in the Hudson. Maybe you want to do something different, but it's there. It's like there are things that are right under your nose that you're not seeing. And it's there for anyone.
I love it.
And I don't know what it is, you know, who's where, doing what, but what would be the challenge for them? Maybe it doesn't have to be a physical challenge. Maybe it's talking to new people or introducing yourself to some executive or something like that, that you can do these things. And what's the risk?
I love it. It's funny. That's one of the reasons that we wanted to have you on the show, just because, you know, like I mentioned before, doing some of the research. I mean, this is what you help others kind of find in themselves, their own Hudson, their own Everest, their own whatever. And we'll get into this here in just a sec. But I mean, I'm assuming you help them with the process, with your philosophy, and different things like that. And as entrepreneurs, we know we have them. I think some of us know what our own Hudson is, but you must work with a lot of people that don't know what their Hudson is. What do you, with your experience and the people that you've helped and that you've coached, how many people kind of know what it is, and how many of them know don't know what's keeping them back or holding them back? Is there a percentage?
Well,
you think?
If someone comes to me with a particular issue, then we work on that issue. I'm not trying to like push them into something that, you know, oh, hey, by the way, there's this thing in life that you don't know about, but I'm going to tell you all about. That's, you know, I'm they're the customer, and I want the customer to be satisfied. So if I'm coaching someone or they come in for a class, then we work on something specific. But I'll tell you, when one of my courses is I call it entrepreneurship, but it's not. Virtually everyone who takes a course says that they've never taken anything like it. It's not about lecture. It's not about passive me telling you answers. It's about experiences, and specifically experiential learning. Mm-hmm. And this happens a lot. People come in, and the first thing we do is we work on, I have them write an essay just to give a feel for them to talk about something that they're interested in, a field for them to work, to focus on. Not yet the problem and not yet the solution, but just the field. And then we start going, and I tell them, you know, you can switch later if you want. And a lot of them they pick something, and increasing numbers, about half or maybe two thirds of the way through the course, actually sometimes earlier, a lot more switch than I expect. Mm-hmm. Over and over again, the switching happens. And by the way, if you do the course, say you're three quarters of the way through, and some of them, like at NYU, you have to, you know, you're going to get a grade. There's an accountability issue, and you know your parents are probably paying for this and stuff. And so you're going to have to redo all the work that you did up until that point. So if you switch, it's a lot of extra work. And people keep finding out that the things that they were looking to do were not actually their interests.
I bet. Interesting.
It was like they thought it was going to be a big thing, or it's a popular thing, or it's a thing that their friends are doing. And the more that they do it, the more that they're like, you know, this one guy taking my course, this one he's doing it online. So not through NYU, just he's an independent person doing the course. He did the leadership course, and now he's doing the entrepreneurship course. And he just posted up his second time doing the personal essay. Or actually, he's doing the exercise after the personal essay, but he's redoing the personal essay because he said, I don't even know why I wrote that stuff before. It's like, it was an interesting thing because people are doing it, but that's not actually what I care about. When I think about what I really care about, and he starts talking about what he really cares about, and he goes, now it's so much easier to find things to work on because I really care about it. And so I don't tell people the answers. I give them experiences. And when they work at it, then there's like so much crap on top of the, like what we really care about. That's a mix of like, you should do this, you should do that, that all our friends say, or the schools or whoever's paying more. And, you know, I've now know what to say to students when they say, you know, I'm mostly done this course, but I'm thinking about switching. And I say, a lot of times, I don't know of any way to find out what you like, except by doing what you think you like. Sometimes it pans out and that's exactly what you like. But sometimes you realize that this was something that people told you. And the only way you can find out is by doing it and realizing you don't really like it that much.
For sure. I mean,
but then I tell them.
Oh, go ahead.
Then I tell them if you go back and start from the beginning, even though it seems like a lot of work, you do it much faster. You're going to enjoy it much more. And you're going to get a lot more out of it because there's a lot of like talking to people out in the world. And when you're calling someone, when you're trying to make a connection to someone you've never met before, and it's in a field that you are abstractly but not actually interested in, it's kind of hard. It's very hard because you have to act like you care to someone who's going to judge you. But when you really do care, like I had a student and she switched from doing something, you know, she did a lot of traveling. And so she was coming up with some travel app. And then she realized that she was really into social work and she really wanted to work in that. And then it was really easy for her to call people because she was like, I told her, if you have a project that you want to work on, and that's going to put you in touch with people that you want to get in touch with, use it as an excuse. Go talk to them. And you know, maybe you'll find out you don't like it. Better you find out now than later. Maybe you'll find out you really like them. And that's what happened, is she started talking to them, and she shared her idea, and they start giving her ideas on how to improve her idea. And next thing you know, she's got something that's better than she would have come up with on her own. She's got a community of people around her that are supporting her, and she's liking what she's doing more. And she did, in 2 weeks, she caught up like a month and a half worth of work because she cared about it. And, you know, hopefully her other courses weren't suffering from her putting her effort into that. But, you know, that's not doing it because that's not carrot or stick. It's internal motivation.
Sure. Which is important as entrepreneurs, for sure. Is this course that you're an adjunct professor? Is this course that you're giving at the school the same one or similar to the one that you give in your private coaching?
Yeah, I came up with the courses, uh-huh. And then I was talking to different places around the city, like incubators and places where a lot of entrepreneurs, and talking to them about saying, this is, you know, I've developed this stuff and it might be useful for you. And I started a company. I was very tech heavy, very analytical. And now I've learned a lot of stuff that's very important. This is a great way to learn it. And so one of them put me in touch with, I guess they were an incubator that was joint with the city and NYU. And that person put me in touch with someone who put me in touch with someone at NYU. And I'm sitting there talking to this guy and I thought I was just having a conversation, and he just points at me and he goes, I'm going to hire you. And I thought, you're the competition.
Yeah.
And part of me was like, I shouldn't work with them because I'm trying to do something independent. But then I realized, you know, there's a lot of resources within a university.
Sure.
I got space and students. And so I started developing it for a strict 14-week, once-a-week way of working, as opposed to when I do it one-on-one, that's very customized. And when I was, you know, the online course is much more flexible. And so when I teach it at NYU, it's very structured. It follows the structure that, you know, everyone who went to college had similar sure. type courses. There's similar structure, but the exercises are different.
Well, let's talk about the philosophy and the process of the actual course. I'm assuming that we're going to have a lot of listeners that are interested in this. So you kind of already mentioned a little bit about it, but let's talk about the philosophy and what we're actually going to see and do as we take the course.
All right. Well, first I'm going to take people from where most people are, or at least I was. So I finished graduate school. I finished my MBA, and I felt that I took some great leadership classes. So I'm Ivy League, top 10, I think at the time it was top 5 business school. And I learned a lot about leadership. I also found that when I would go out and do leadership type things, like walk into a big negotiation about, or a sales situation, or trying to, or investor situation, or you know, getting investment in one of my businesses, or trying to set up a contract with the city of New York or one of my businesses, stuff like that, I'd walk in and I'd still get really tongue-tied. And I wouldn't really know what to do. I knew what to do, but I didn't know how to do it. Well, the way I put it usually is like, I learned about leadership, but I did not learn to lead.
Interesting.
I learned about entrepreneurship, but it wasn't really what I needed to know how to do. And so over the course of the past 10 years, I've been developing experience and things like that since I graduated, since I got the degree. And, you know, one of the big things you learn is that experience counts for a lot. And part of the way, my friends noticed that I was changing a lot, that, you know, with leadership, you don't just learn this stuff. With entrepreneurship, you don't just learn this stuff. It becomes a part of you. It's not like abstract facts. Like, I learned about electrons and physics. I didn't feel like an affinity toward electrons. Mm-hmm. But when you learn how to communicate with people, your relationships improve. You know, all of them, not just business relationships, with family and friends and people you meet. And so they're like, Josh, you should coach. You should write this stuff up. You should do stuff. You should get this out there. Because something's changed about you, and you get better advice than you ever did. You seem more calm and things like that. So I started, at first I started doing, I thought, okay, I'm just going to do better job of what the school did for me. And the school taught me through lecture and case study overwhelmingly. So I was trying to create better lectures. And now I went out and I would do some workshops and some lectures, and people gave me positive feedback that they liked it. But increasingly I would learn more and more about how to teach. And so of the past 10 years, the past maybe 3 to 5 years has been a lot of work into learning how to teach. Mm-hmm. and how we learn. And so project-based, experiential, active learning was something like going back to John Dewey and Montessori and names like that. And a friend of mine started a school in Philadelphia, which is an inquiry-driven, project-based learning school. And I spent a lot of time there learning from people who were deeply immersed. I mean, that school is from the ground up, that style of learning. You walk into a classroom and there not a single classroom has kids sitting in rows being talked to. You can't even tell who the teacher is if you don't look too closely, because everyone's walking around and researching and playing and making stuff. And so I deeply immersed myself in this community of people who've learned this style of learning, and realized it was much more effective for something, for a purely academic field, might not be the best thing, but for something so active, social, experiential, emotional, performance-based, like the type of business that I do, hustling, you know, leadership and entrepreneurship, it's much more effective, sales. And so on the one hand, okay, I was learning a lot of this pedagogy. I didn't make it up. You know, I'm looking at what works and taking what works. I also looked at a lot of fields that were similar. So like the big ones are like, I was watching Inside the Actor's Studio. I used to watch it because I liked it. I still watch it.
Yeah, great and show.
I love it. And I'm noticing all the stuff that I learned in leadership, not all of it, a lot of stuff that I learned in leadership, especially the social interaction, the emotional expressiveness, and the ability to read others' emotion. These actors had it way beyond the teachers I learned it from, my classmates. Most business leaders would dream of having the skills to perform and to read others like the people inside the actor studio. But the more that I'd listen to them, the more I'd find out they were kicked out of school, they dropped out of school, they were told not to come back. Like, how does this, I'm at the pinnacle of this style of education, and yet people who were totally disconnected from it and disengaged from it are doing better on some things that are critically important. And that's what I learned about, like names like Stanislavski and Stella Adler and Lee Strasberg, and ended up taking Meisner technique, some courses in leadership, in acting, in order to learn how they were learning what they were learning. And I found that it was tremendously useful, and it was a style of learning. You know, we've been teaching acting. It's a more mature field than how long we've been teaching leadership. And there's some things that work there. And the more I thought about it, the more I realized there's commonalities in how we teach acting and how we teach other things that are like it, like sports. I'm always amazed at how you watch college sports and there's like this 20-year-old kid performing in front of 100 million people. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe 50,000 in the stadium and however many on TV. How is this guy calm? How is this guy able to like not just completely lose it? Well, it's rehearsal and practice and going through drills and things like that. And increasingly, I realized that let me add one more element, was that after school, I also started working with this guy, Marshall Goldsmith, who in my field is like the peak. He's, you know, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, number one bestseller. He's named like the number one leadership thinker in the world and stuff like that. And I contacted him and he's become my mentor. And he doesn't teach through lecture and case study. He teaches through, he does mostly coaching. And I learned from him a couple exercises. And if you go online, you can look up feed forward, or you can look up no but however. And these are exercises. I'm not going to explain them, but because mm-hmm. you can look it up. But they're very effective. And they're just, here's a thing to do. And if you do it, you'll learn. And it's not like you can, if I tell you what you would learn, you'd be like, you wouldn't actually learn it. It'd be me like telling you, here are the keys on the piano to play a C major scale. It's not the same as knowing how to play it. If you do know how to play it, then you've learned something different than a bunch of facts. And in my coaching, I liked how he coached using techniques like that. And I started building more and more exercises. So my coaching, you know, I'm not a psychologist. I'm not a psychoanalyst. I'm not there to analyze your problems. I'm there to help you solve problems and make things better. If that's not the way that you work, that's fine. That's the way I work. And for the people that work with me, it works very well. And so over the years, I would add, every time someone had an issue, I would make up an exercise for them to do that was in the style of his. You know, quick to describe, quick nice. To learn, something you could practice in a week. And at the end of the week, you'd have some new skill. So like if they had an issue with their CEO, like they didn't know how to communicate with the person, I would give them an exercise in communication that they could do with not the CEO, you know, low stakes, with friends, family, maybe colleagues. And after a week of practicing, maybe they'd be able to do it with their CEO. Maybe they'd need more practice. But after a while, I realized that I had built up, I think I had 45 exercises that I, you know, feed forward. Marshalls were some of them. I didn't make them all up. Some of them I got from other places. If it works, I don't care. For me, what matters is if it works for my client, not if I made it up or not.
Sure.
And at the beginning, I thought, oh, here, look, 45, that's pretty close to 52. Maybe I'll make a weekly, year-long course. And I knew that was too long, but and then I noticed some were slightly different than others. And so eventually it broke down. So there was like a leadership track and an entrepreneurship track. And the leadership track was about 20 exercises. The entrepreneurship track was about 10 exercises. Then there's some others that, also I knew that I wanted to limit it. I didn't want to make like a 6 month long course. That would probably be too long. So, all of these things came together of having having these exercises that were modeled after Marshall's. So simple, but not necessarily easy, but simple to learn, easy to practice, straightforward to practice.
Sure.
Then there was experiential learning, which I was learning from these practitioners and from my friend's school and from the theory that I would learn it. And then my practicing through coaching and through teaching at NYU. And then the acting stuff and my experiences of learning how we teach other fields that are active and social, experiential, emotional, and performance-based. And all of that came together around the same time this guy points at me and goes, well, I'm going to hire you. And then once I started teaching, then, you know, full time, because I'm an adjunct, I'm going to teach full time. But once I started teaching really regularly, then it all really came together. And over the past several years, it's really settled down to like, these are the courses that in me are the most valuable, that I enjoy teaching the most, that the students seem to get the most out of, that, at some point I'm going to get in trouble because students are going to drop out of college because they're going to take my course. They're going to be like, now I got what I need. And I'd rather go off and do what I'm ready to do than write more papers.
So on the private side is those that take your course, do they have access to you as well for one-on-one, or how does that work?
So right now there's the courses that are online, and anyone can take the courses, and it's the same structure as the in-class university ones. We don't actually meet in person as we would there, but you also pay a lot less. Mm-hmm. But also each exercise works like this. You sign up for the course and you go to the first page, and the first page says, here's this exercise. The first exercise that you do, there's a little description of it. Then there's a specific, like step by step, here's what you do. There's also a recording of me describing it to someone. So if someone early on, I walked that person through it and recorded all these conversations. And so you hear me describing it. And then he asks me back like, well, what about this? What about that? And then at the bottom, there's a checklist. And when you finish doing the exercise, you check off the checklist. And then the reflection box appears. And that's where you write your reflection. And, you know, this being one of the things that pedagogically is like very valuable is to, you learn by doing, but you really reinforce it by, you internalize it when you reflect on it. So after you reflect, after you write your reflection, which is It's nothing really big, but it's a minimum of 250 words. You click submit, and that puts your reflection up on the forum, and it gives you access to that exercise forum. And now you can read all the reflections of everyone who's done
it. Oh, really? Nice.
See how? Yeah, because no two people do them the same. And you pick up how different people have done it, and you can post on theirs, and they can post on yours. And so you can, all the people who do it in school all go do it as a single cohort all at the same time. But the people who do it at home do it at their own pace. Sometimes something comes up, and they take a week to do one, and they take a month to do the next, and the next they do in 2 days. And so because the stuff is always up there on the forum, you can go at whatever pace you want. You can always look at what other people are doing. And then at the end, also on the forum, is you get, I give a brief write-up of my take on that exercise, and you hear another conversation between me and Chris, the guy who I recorded the conversations with. And those conversations are usually longer, and he describes how it went for him and what worked and what didn't. And I tell him, you know, you had this experience, a lot of other people have that experience, and he reflects on that. So a lot of times, not a lot of times, but sometimes someone will post the reflection, which was before listening to the conversation between me and Chris. And then they'll post immediately after that, right underneath that, they'll say, you know, now after listening to Chris, I realized this or that.
Huh.
And so you don't get directly with me, but you kind of do, because I've written everything. There's the conversations with me and Chris. I respond to a lot of people. At some point in the future, I will not be able to respond as much as I do now, and it'll have to be a premium service for me to directly interact with people.
Which makes sense.
And there's always one-on-one coaching, which is, that's, you know, going to be more expensive, but it's also much more personal.
With all the things that you've done, with all the entrepreneurs, executives that you've talked to throughout the years, and this might be too broad of a question, is there a common theme as to some of the things that are holding entrepreneurs back from kind of getting to the level that they want to be?
I'm not sure if there's one common thing, but I can tell you at the top is, all right, I'll use the language that is like the standard language, but it's not that helpful, is, you know, it's a lack of self-awareness. I had an executive, he was a CFO at a major media company. And, you know, he said something very powerful to me. He said, well, first of all, I should say that he had an MBA, he was very successful, he moved up the ranks very well. He was making a lot of money. He had a family that was loving and caring, mutually supportive. And it all sounds great. So why is he calling me for coaching? Hmm. And he says, you know, I think he was in his 50s. So he said, if I continue the way that I'm going, I'm going to retire in 10 or 15 years, very rich, and I'll have no idea what it was all about. It's a very powerful thing for someone to say.
I bet.
You know, it was like he was great on the values of other people, money and power and fame and things like that. Those, he, you know, pick a thing, he knew what to do, and he achieved it. His own values, he wasn't so knowledgeable about. He wasn't so aware of. And the reason I say that, I specify that I'm using like the standard language, is that it's not very useful to go to someone and say, you should increase your self-awareness. What, you know, if you have it, you need to hear it. And
yep.
If you don't have it, you hear that doesn't help you at all. So the way that I think about it is that they all could use similar type experiences that just school hasn't provided, that life doesn't provide, unless, you know, some people get lucky and they run through a series of exercises or run through a series of experiences, I should say, that lead them to develop certain things. That a lot of us look at them and say, oh, they must have been born with it. But I don't think anyone's born with self-awareness. I think, you know, some people have experiences that lead them to pick it up. And others of us don't. But the reason I created these courses is that so many people, however you would describe the issue, the solution was the same. And that's why these exercises, I found myself giving similar exercises to so many people.
You there?
Yeah.
Okay.
So, yeah. So,
go ahead.
Yeah, just giving exercise. I mean, I would give similar exercises to similar people, and they would get similar results and tell me similar levels of satisfaction and feelings of of, you know, increased confidence and personal growth and things like that. And they were, you know, great for me. This isn't the best business thing, but, you know, I really want people to be independent of me. I don't want people dependent on me. I give them stuff that once they have it, you know, they don't need me anymore. And, you know, the one guy came to me, he was the tech co-founder of a business, and the business was successful. And so there's the business co-founder, him, and then there became one investor. And so there are three people. And the reason he contacted me was that the other two were looking to buy him out. And he didn't know if he had a good deal or not. And he saw that I had my entrepreneurial background and that I had the business background. And so he thought, Josh can help me. So he didn't know. Okay, what are the things he didn't know? He didn't know whether it was a good deal or not. He didn't know how to value the company. And it's not like they hadn't been long enough that you could do a discounted cash flow or earnings multiple or something like that. He didn't know if it was a good deal. Like, he knew how many years he had worked there and he knew how much money it was. But maybe they're trying to, like, make a killing off of him. Mm-hmm. Maybe he was leaving a lot of money on the table. But more importantly, he didn't know if they were trying to help him or hurt him. If this was a friendly maneuver, what was going on? He didn't know how to make sense of it. And he didn't even know how to find out these things. And he didn't know what to do about it. Should he negotiate? Should he just take the deal and go? He didn't know. So I spent a while working with him just to frame it. And, you know, there are a couple of simple things. I told him, read Getting to Yes. That's a book that I find very valuable, like the book on negotiation. So he read that. That helped him a lot. That gave him some tried and true strategy and ways of understanding how to negotiate. I also put him through a lot of exercises of how to talk to someone, how to get the others to feel comfortable sharing what's going on in a way that's not like, what are you doing? You're trying to pull one over on me, or are you trying to help me, or what? It's to have relationships that aren't strictly, I'm in one role, you're in another role, and this is what my role is supposed to do, and that's what your role is supposed to do, but more, I'm a human being, you're a human being, let's talk like human beings and understand where we're coming from. And as he did that, he started realizing that the other two had different goals than him. They wanted, you know, one of them had a family and really wanted a stable income, and he wanted to grow, and growth and stability were not going to be necessarily mutually compatible. And so they wanted a more stable thing than he wanted. He was much younger. And when that came out, he realized the signs had actually been there all along. He just didn't know how to read them. Mm-hmm. And he saw that this wasn't like, it wasn't a matter of good deal, bad deal. It was a matter of going in different directions, and it made sense for him. And on top of that, he knew how to negotiate, and he could negotiate now not from a position of like fear or confusion or anxiety, but of looking on to what he wanted to do next in life and what he needed for that, and seeing how the business was going to run. And so what, you know, he had a good sense of what was available. And yeah, I can tell you, he negotiated a much bigger deal than the amount he paid me. So he was very happy about that.
I bet.
And then after that, he was like, okay, it's time for me to start my new business. And like everyone, he's like looking around at, I'm leading through these exercises of what to do. And, you know, it doesn't take him long before he realizes, I started this business right out of school and I haven't learned a lot about life. And he's like, Josh, I'm loving these exercises, but it's time for me to travel and I got to go discover the world. And I'm like, I was surprised that you were so quick into starting something immediately after selling the thing. And he went off and traveled. And then the next thing I know, I don't know, it was probably 6 months later, he's like, okay, Josh, I want to start a company now. I've traveled and I've done that. And it wasn't right for me, but I couldn't have known except by doing it. And then we got back on track on doing exercises. And that sort of thing, look at the things that he didn't know. He didn't know how to read a relationship. He didn't know how to create a relationship beyond just role playing. He didn't know what to do about it. And it wasn't that hard for him to get these things. It's just, in my case, I have more experience. I spent time working on how to gain these things.
You know, a lot of people are going to listen to this episode. They're going to read your bio. They're going to see a lot of the things that you've done. Obviously, they're going to see that very impressive, and you know, you have a lot of experience. Tell us about some of the things that maybe were some roadblocks in your life. I mean, you know, with 5 degrees and all these things, people are going to say, you know, maybe things are just easy for him because he's just was born at a different level. But there must have been some things that you struggled with or are trying to adjust now as well. Can you talk about some of those things?
Yeah, I mean, there's one is when I, first of all, I went into physics because I love physics, and I still love physics. When I started doing research, I realized that a research style lifestyle was not right for me. Uh-huh. So I'm 3 or 4 years into my PhD. I got 2 or 3, maybe 4 years left. So at the time, I was, do I want to continue what I'm doing because I'm most of the way done? Do I want to leave? I didn't know anything about the rest of the world. I mean, academia was my life. And some friends of mine had the idea to start a company, and I hadn't yet had the idea for it. It was with them that we had the idea to start the company. So physics prepares you for a lot, and inventing something makes you CEO of a company, but that doesn't mean you know how to run the company.
Sure.
And so we got started in the early 2000s, and when we launched, I mean, our launch date, here's a roadblock. We have these, I have a few of these invitations still, printed cards that we sent out to everyone, like all the investors and people involved. We're like, come to this thing. It's going to be the global launch of this brand new medium. It's going to be a big media event. Come to it September 11th, 2001.
Oh, shoot. Oh, no.
So, I mean, we'd been planning on getting some revenue there. And I don't want to say that on the scale of things that happened that day, you know, ours was not on the scale of others. But suddenly we couldn't go into, you know, it was a business that had involved Subways. And Subways were like not letting anyone do anything. And advertising was like completely dried up. And then the capital markets were all dry. So suddenly I found myself in a place where every source of money was gone. And, you know, at the time I thought that was the issue. More of the issue was I did not have experience in handling a team going through very difficult periods. Mm-hmm. So I was very command and control. You know, I learned leadership from like watching TV, which is dramatic.
Yeah.
And so it wasn't long before we were just on fumes. And the investors squeezed me out, and I didn't know what was going on. Like, how do I know how to help this guy who I just talked about? Because I was on the wrong side of it. I was on the side of it of helpless, not really knowing what to do. Like, when things are going well, everyone's pulling together. But when things aren't going well, everyone wants their piece.
Sure.
And suddenly I'm like, who's on my side? I mean, I have to tell you, that's when my relationship with my mother improved the most, because she was the one person, one of the few people. You know, I had a couple trusted advisors who I felt understood me and helped me. But everyone else was like, they were trying to get theirs. Or, you know, I'm simplifying it now over the years. But I wasn't really eating well at the time. You know, not a big health issue, but, you know, I just felt like I'd be working and I'd get hungry and I'd think, what's my hunger compared to this business? I got to get this thing working. And it was really painful. I mean, nowadays people talk about, they throw the word failure around like it's candy. Like, fail early, fail often, fail, yeah. fail.
We hear that all the time,
you
know, for sure.
Let's fail all the time. I've never once, of all these people talking about failure, I'm sure they felt it, but I've never once heard someone describe the feelings that you get and making it visceral and real of fear, anxiety, humiliation, futility, worrying. It's like, it's overwhelming. And yeah, fail, you have to fail to learn. And I don't call it failure. I mean, you know, we call it learning experiences and things like that. I've gotten to a stage where when things don't go the way that I expected, I know that I'm not going to die. I'm going to figure out what to do, how to do it a little different the next time. But you only get that through these experiences that, you know, when the people like fail early, fail often, they're not capturing this emotional side of it. So when you talk about roadblocks, I was like, devastated. I'd said no to physics, and now my business was like, I was kicked out. Like, they moved and they didn't give me a key to the new office.
Oh,
that's like pretty brutal.
Sure.
And I can say this because one of the big things I did in business school, my first application was to restore my relationships with people in my old company and get myself back on board and being a major part of it. That makes it easier to talk about now. Well, now it's water under the bridge. It's a long time ago. Also business school, I thought, all right, I've been running a business. So business, I know. I certainly know a lot of math. So all that spreadsheet stuff, that'll be easy. And I wasn't even through orientation before I got a huge dose of humility of realizing like all the emotional stuff, the leadership stuff. I had no idea what was going on. I could say I had the most to learn of anyone. Yes. And all the stuff with the spreadsheets and stuff, I didn't know what was going on either. I was like, I was totally lost for the first semester and most of the second semester too.
With all the work that you've done, you know, you talked about, so you've run businesses, you've had all of the success with your education. You have the course, you're teaching right now, the courses you have, and you're teaching. You have the book, which we'll get to here in just a sec. You're 44. I mean, you still have a lot left in you. What's the next, I usually say 5 years, but for you, what are the next 3 years going to look like for you?
Oh man, you know, I remember when I was interviewing at places and schools and things like that, you often get the question of like, what's to come? And, you know, when I was in college, I loved reading the course catalog back when it was a written book, and because it wasn't online. There was no online for it to be. And I used to, like, I'd take the courses, and I'd regret all the courses I couldn't take because they all sounded so interesting. And I'd think, okay, I'll do this and then this, and I'll have the next 20 years planned out. And the next semester, I'd pick a bunch of different courses, and it would be an entirely new next 20 years of my life. And so every semester, I'd completely revamp everything. And then by graduate school, I realized that I wouldn't look that far ahead because I couldn't plan past what experiment I was going to work on. Mm-hmm. And then when I was working on my company and the investors were like, okay, what's success of your business? How big is big? And that sort of stuff. I realized I could plan even less far ahead. And now I just don't think that far ahead.
Yeah.
It's much more about how do I, having experience to handle things and what's my situation now. And I have ideas of where I want to go. I certainly want my course. My courses have recently gone up. And I, you know, the reason I make them is because I think for a big population, they're going to be very valuable. And I would like these to become very big. I'd like to serve the world. And so that gives me direction. But what I do on a day-to-day basis is much more free. And it's, you know, if you look on my blog, if you look up Samurai Walk, you'll see a little video I did of this technique, or this way of a belief, a mental model of how to look at how to plan. And instead of trying to plan rigidly and sticking to a rigid plan, it's much more flexible and much more taking into account how everything changes every step of the way. So where I might be in 3 years, I don't know. I think that the courses would get big. I mean, I hope that my courses will have an effect in leadership. Like someone who's mentored me to some degree is David Allen, who did Getting Things Done. Mm-hmm. And that was a tremendous book for me and for a lot of people. And I'd love to have an effect like that. And that book, as far as I know, there's nothing that has replaced it in, like, I don't know, 10 or 15 years since it's come out.
Let's talk about
I'd
your
love
book.
To have an effect like that.
Uh-huh. Let's talk about your book. So you're working on one now, but let's talk about this other one. I believe it was published 2013, Remodel. So create mental models to improve your life and lead simply and effectively. Came out 2013. Let's discuss it. What did you want to get across with this book?
Sure. There's the concept of mental models, or I like to use the term beliefs, because I think mental models are kind of jargony. But I use the terms interchangeably. So the beliefs that we have about the world filter how we see them. If, you know, if we're both in a room with a dog and I was once bitten by one and you had one just like it as a pet, we might look at the exact same dog and you might think it's cuddly and I might think it's scary, even though it's the exact same thing. Mm-hmm. And how we change the beliefs that we have that come from our experiences filter how we see the world. And it determines to some degree what kind of world we live in. So if you're scared of a lot of things, you might live in a scary world. If you're very confident, you might live in a non-scary world and be confident about a lot of things. And Peter Drucker has a story about the three stone cutters.
Yeah, let's get into it.
So the story is like someone's walking along and there's three people cutting stone, and one of them looks kind of miserable, like doing drudge work. The next one is like kind of like enjoying the work. And the next one is like standing tall and really enjoying what they're doing. And so the person in the story goes up to the first one and says, "What are you doing?" And the person says, "I'm making a living. Like, I got to do something. So this is what I'm doing. I'm chopping stone." And the person goes to the next one and says, "What are you doing?" And that person says, "Well, I'm very good at chopping stone. I'm a master craftsman." and this is what I do, and I'm doing it very well, and so I'm practicing my craft. And then they go to the third one, who's like really happy, and say, what are you doing? And this person says, I'm building one of the most beautiful cathedrals that's ever been built. And the perspective, well, different people have different perspectives on it, but to me, it's like you can do the exact same thing. And if you have the belief of you're building a cathedral, you're going to feel, you're going to be happier, you're going to get more work done, you're going to have more friends and all sorts of things like that. And a lot of people think these beliefs are fixed or we're kind of stuck with them.
Yeah, I was going to ask, are we born with these beliefs?
We're born with a system that forms beliefs. I mean, we live in a world that our brains can handle so much information. There's much more information in the universe than there is our brains can handle. So we simplify and we make beliefs. And so we have a system. As far as I can tell, our brains, we have to make simplifications. But we have a choice of what simplifications we make. Most people don't exercise that choice. They don't realize they can choose it. Well, I mean, look, you thought you were a child one day, and now you don't think you're a child. I don't think you do. And you could say, well, the world changed, and I became not a child. Okay, it did. But you also don't believe what you once did. Mm-hmm. So if you can change about that, what else can you change about?
Sure. Makes sense.
And so I don't believe that I can fly, but I do believe that I can contact anyone from any company if I take the right steps in between. And so I do things like that. So I meet lots of people that other people don't. But anyone can do it. But if you have a belief that you can't, or that you'll be humiliated if you do, and it's too big of a risk to take, you won't do things that you're capable of, even though you could. So somewhere along the lines, I had a belief that was, a lot of times someone will do something, and I think, oh, that's cool. And I'll think, oh, if that person can do it, I can do it too. And then it makes me curious about what led them to be able to do something like that. And then I just follow in their footsteps. So, you know, I'm not going to become Usain Bolt or Michael Jordan. I don't think I could win an NBA championship at this age. But those are real edge cases. I mean, most people can't do that. Mm-hmm. I mean, Scottie Pippen wasn't Michael Jordan.
Sure.
And he was a lot closer to that than I was. So, and there's plenty of other things that I can do that are my own outlier things.
So is this book, if we read it, when we read it, we're going to walk away with the ability to do what? Or think how or what?
If you only read it, you'll probably think it's an interesting book. But if you notice that chapter 2 specifically describes an exercise to do, and the exercise is to pay attention to the beliefs that you have on a day-to-day basis. And it was an exercise that I gave my clients, and it's an exercise that I gave myself. And so every day people can do this. You don't have to read the book. But if you, here's the exercise. For 1 week, carry every day with you something that you can write on and something that you can write with. And when you notice a belief that's filtering your perception, write it down. So if your belief is that dogs are scary, write down dogs are scary. If your belief is anything someone else can do, I can do too, write that down. And I thought, the first time I did this, I thought, oh, this is cool. I'm going to write down these really key beliefs that I've come up with over the past few years. And I'm going to write down like 5, maybe 10 beliefs. And by the end of the week, I was up to something like 70. And I was writing them faster at the end than I was at the beginning. Mm-hmm. And I realized that more valuable than individual beliefs were two things. One, being able to sense them. Noticing what they are. This is a big piece of self-awareness.
Oh, I love that.
And the other thing is flexibility, being able to change them. Once you see how many beliefs you have, and you see sometimes they're contradicting each other, sometimes they're different than other people's, sometimes you see how it came into be, and then you realize you can change these beliefs. You're not changing the world. You're changing a representation of it in your head. I mean, we're comfortable when we read a book title like Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus. And obviously men are not from Mars. Women are not from Venus. We're all from Earth. But it's a useful belief to kind of have in your head sometimes. And it's not, you don't confuse it with reality, but it's a useful mental model. And sometimes there are things like that you stick in your head and it works. And then you start realizing it. Oh, yeah, sorry?
No, go ahead. Go finish that thought.
Well, there are a lot of times people have a belief and they think, well, this belief is true. This belief is accurate. And if you want me to switch it, that's just putting lipstick on a pig. Mm-hmm. But every belief has some simplification, has some flaw in it that you never know when that little belief is going to be off. And people who are stuck on right and wrong, they don't realize how, you know, men are from Mars, women are from Venus, leads people, it led a lot of people to improve their lives. And they don't believe that men are really from Mars.
Sure.
But also there are some beliefs that really do. I mean, so the rest of the book after chapter two is me going through and writing out all the beliefs that came up through this exercise. And I put more depth into it, more, I described them more than just like the top level of it. So like one is that, there's one that in my head, what I remember is I have low standards the first time. And this is a way to motivate myself to do things, is that if I have high standards for myself, the first time I do stuff, I often don't do them because I'm worried about doing well. So by giving myself low standards, generally, if there's something I want to do, like the first webinar that I ever did was it like didn't go very well. I mean, I'm talking on a computer. I've never done that before. So, but by my low standards, my standard was, did I do it? Yes, success. And so I did something that I wouldn't have done back when I had high standards. I wouldn't have done it. So that was a belief that I picked up at some point, is if I give myself low standards, I'll do more things. And the strategy that emerged was to give myself low standards the first time I do things. Then, you know, of course, I iterate after that and try to improve.
Sure. And we're going to have a link to the book on our website. But as we start to wrap this down a little bit, overall, with everything you've done, the experiences that you've had, if there's one central belief or one core piece of advice that comes from you to our audience, something that's actionable, what would that be to help them improve their entrepreneurial journey?
It's hard for me not to answer this in a way that's going to sound salesy, but the past 10 years of my life have been refining that into the courses. Mm-hmm. And if I could distill them any more, that I would. But that is my contribution to everyone who was like me, very analytical, very geeky, or very not taking risks, not knowing what to do, not really knowing, you know, being layered on with other people's values and not really knowing what my own values were, and realizing that it's through experiencing new experiences. You know, I apologize if I'm going to answer this a little too long.
No, go ahead.
When I was in college, we had to read Aristotle, and I read Aristotle, and I was okay. And, you know, they were asking, one of the big things they asked was like, what's a good life? What's a good life and how to live a better life? And that's a pretty big question. That's an important question. And I think that people who know philosophy better than me may point out that I'm getting things wrong. If so, please contact me and let me know. But I think that their approach was to talk through, logic it out, to figure out through information around us, how can we figure out what a good life is and how to make mine better? And the fact that there's a quote out there that says all of philosophy is footnotes to Aristotle tells me that people after him were like, okay, those guys back then got the big questions. Now we got to deal with all the little questions that are less important. And I think that approaching things that way is kind of like approaching like music through talking about it. It is an approach, but it's not going to get you really like learn how to play or give you the feeling of what it's like to hear a piece of music. Mm-hmm. And my approach is, instead of talking it out or reasoning it out, nothing wrong with that. That's got one way, but it's to, instead of giving people answers, I give people experiences so that when they do these experiences, they will discover the answers on their own in a way that they never could without going through this experience. And so it's an experiential way, a comprehensive, integrated set of experiences that when you do them, it leads you to answer the same questions that they were thinking about back then, but through a different approach. And I tried to make an approach that starts off very simple, that anyone can do, and quickly leads you into some very advanced stuff that, you know, leading others, you can lead others very effectively, you inspire them. Leading yourself, you can realize a lot of things about yourself. And so wrapping that up, it's like, I think it's an approach to living a good life, leading people, having great relationships, being very effective and getting a lot done, that as far as I know, no one's done before. And at least for the people who have found me so far, it's been very effective.
I love it. I'm glad that we're able to expose some of the things that you're working on, some of the things that you're doing to our audience. I think it's going to be very beneficial. When all of this is said and done, how do you want to be remembered?
So, actually, can you hear me okay? Because the connection sounds a little not so great.
Yeah, I can hear you just fine. Yeah.
Okay. You know, when I started my first business, it was building an advertising medium. And I loved it because it was my invention. I created it. I built it. But in no way did I want my gravestone to say he invented an advertising medium that got more ads to people that never advertisers couldn't reach before. Like, that was troubling to me. Now I think a lot of what I do is I'm not solving people's problems. I enable people to create meaning and value in their lives and in the lives of people around them. And I'm happy for that to be on my gravestone.
I love that. That's perfect. You're bringing value to those that come in contact with you. You know, at the end of the day, really, what else can you ask for, right?
Yeah, I think it's delivering them value, but ultimately, they are creating the value themselves. I'm giving them the tools to do it.
Great. Perfect. Good answer. Josh, tell us where we can find you online.
So the best place right now is joshuaspodek.com. So joshuaspodek.com. My Twitter, I think, is Spodek. Actually, I hardly use Twitter, so I think it's Spodek. And then now I'm in a transition period. So if immediately around now, I'm about to put up a new page for the course, and that will be fundamentalsofhustling.com. And that's where the courses will be. Right now, if it's in like the next month or two, you go to joshuaspodek.com and click on courses if you are interested in them. And also, I don't think you mentioned it, but I post every single day, and I posted every day for going into 6 years now. So there's a lot of material there.
Yeah, there's a lot of good content there. We doing research, like we mentioned. I think I mentioned it offline. Obviously, we've been looking into the things that you're doing to kind of prepare for this episode. You have a lot of content coming out, and a lot of good content coming out. I guess last question then with this: where do you find the time, and where does you know, it's not easy to come up with an article a week. You're doing something every single day. How is that possible?
The answer to that, the short answer is that a lot of people say you must be disciplined to do all those things, and I think they got cause and effect backwards. Doing those things gives me discipline. I can be as lazy as anybody else. And there's a concept that I'm not going to go into now, but I call it a sidcha. I don't know. Did you come across sidcha when you were reading my stuff?
I didn't see it, no.
Okay, so I'll just leave it as a teaser. For those who are interested, if you go to my blog and look up SIDCHA, and there's a video, the video that I did from a webinar is like the best introduction to it. But if you look up sidcha, then that will answer your question. So I apologize if people are annoyed that I'm not giving them the answers right now.
No, this is a good one. That's good. They'll have to go up and look it up.
Yeah, a little teaser.
So Outliers, you can go to outliermagazine.co. That's outliermagazine.co. First of all, subscribe to our podcast, rate, review it. But there you're going to be able to find Josh's website, links to social media, links, or channels, and we'll also have a link to the book. Josh, hey, this has been amazing. We really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us, to share your story, the things that you've learned, the things that you're doing now. I think it's going to be very valuable for our audience, so we really appreciate you being on the show.
I hope so. I really enjoyed the conversation, and I look forward to crossing paths, and I hope that it is of value to people, the conversation and whatever content they find.
No doubt, and we'll definitely be in touch. So Outliers, we'll talk to you tomorrow.